case of deja vu, really. It feels like a week here at New Year, and here I am again. As I mentioned in my prayer, it's, I think about it like I've chosen an easier book to look at rather than the book of Nahum. What we have to remember as we come to God's Word that all Scripture is given by inspiration of God and it's all profitable for us. So as we look through it, it's not a case of, has it got anything to say to us? We have to say, yes, it does have something to say to us. What is it? And as I was looking through, I had to think to myself, that is the case. As we look at God's Word, it's not, has it got anything to say that's relevant to us? But it has. It does speak to us. So as you look at it, we really need to get under the skin a bit and see what it is that God's saying to us. I'm not planning to recap over everything I said last week. So we've looked at some verses already in chapter 1. I'm not planning to do that. I'm planning to just move on to verse 14 and 15. Because I know that last week they get a bit carried away with time. I wasn't sure what the time was, so we're going to just finish off from where we ended last week. Saying that, however, this is a prophecy that was prophesied in history. We do need to have an understanding of the context for it. So I will be going over some things again with you, just putting this prophecy in the context of the time in which it was given. So even though I won't go over some of the verses we looked at, I will try and put it back in the context for those of you who weren't here last week. Which I know is a fair few of you. And I know quite a few away that were here last week, so I'm not worried about that now, but again. Some of you were here last week, so you're going to just help those who weren't here last week. So, first of all, I'll just put some prompts out there, and if you could just chip in and say what you think the answers might be. It's not a quiz, it's just a... I'll just facilitate the session and we'll just share what we know. So, this prophecy of Nahum, who was the prophecy for and why was it given? Who was the prophecy for? Who was it to?
It's to Israel about Nineveh or Syria and it's given as encouragement.
Okay, thank you. So, this prophecy comes to God's people in the land of Judah. To them, and I've got written down here, it's for encouragement, as Bruce just said, absolutely, it was an encouragement to God's people. Often prophecies came to God's people and it was a challenge to them, or it was a warning to them. This message came, and it was an encouragement to God's people who were in Judah. Let's look at our map and remind ourselves of where they were. So we have Judah down here. And the message is coming to them from Nahum, who probably was in Judah as well, and he's bringing this message to them. He might have been in Nineveh, he might have been captured from the land of Israel and sent the message down as a letter, we're not sure. Anyway, the message comes to Judah and it is encouragement. What was special about Nahum's name? Look to this very quickly. Come on, Bruce, I know you know. Name? Other people do know as well.
Comfort.
Okay, Nahum's name means comfort. Okay, because it was a message of comfort to God's people. When was Nahum prophesying? When did this prophecy come?
Came after the Israelites have been taken.
Okay.
The northern kingdom have been taken before the captivity of Judah.
Okay. So Israel has already been taken into captivity. The Assyrians have already conquered the land of Israel. They've conquered all of this area here. We've got shaded in here. The land of Israel, the tribe of Israel has been taken, the nation of Israel has been captured, taken to the capital city already. But Judah so far hasn't been taken into captivity because the Babylonians haven't taken over yet. And that will happen in Babylonian times. So, is our timeline I showed you last week. So, birth of Christ here. This is BC now, we're working backwards. So 750 years before Christ, we've got Jonah preaching. Then the nation of Israel taken into exile, 720 years before Christ. And then we're now here. So after that time, 630 years before Christ, we're thinking roughly is when he's prophesying, and then Nineveh falls, and Assyria as a nation are completely exterminated in 612 BC. And once again, we'll refer to this incident when Sennacherib attacks against Jerusalem. Right, so that's a quick recap. The second thing I need to quickly recap on is, as I did last week, was just to tell you a little bit about the nation of, or the nation of Assyria. They come down at once, and we've got an incident recorded for us when they come down to Jerusalem. Before that, the king comes down, he's heading down this way with his army, and they come to Lachish, and I mentioned last week that they surround Lachish, they have battering rams, and they batter down Lachish, even though it's got huge walls, they've got wheeled battering rams. And we know what happened because the king at that time, King Sennacherib, he actually did a huge picture of it, carved in stone, 80 foot long, which he had in his palace. So we know that they came down and they attacked Lachish. Why am I telling you this? Because also in this illustration of the event, it shows the Jewish people being impaled on spikes. It shows them being skinned alive. It tells you how awful this nation of Assyria was, and how much they hated God and hated God's people, and how they treated their enemies. Okay, an evil nation. And they come down, and they're encamped at Lachish. From there, the king then sends, as I mentioned last week, the Rabshakeh down, and the Rabshakeh comes to Jerusalem. He's the spokesperson for King Sennacherib, and he comes down to Jerusalem. Remember, he stands outside Jerusalem, on the hill surrounding Jerusalem, he starts talking to three spokespeople that come out from Jerusalem. Hezekiah sends out the three spokespeople, and the Rabshakeh comes with an army of Sennacherib with him and his, you know, entourage. And he stands there and he says to them, "You should submit to us. Who's your God that's going to save you?" And he starts taunting them and saying, you know, "Who's God? Every nation we've come against, they've got their gods and we've just destroyed them. Who's your God that's going to save you?" Maybe if we just turn to Isaiah 36, we won't read it all, but it's good to just put this message, this prophecy in the context of these events that we find finding God's word. So chapter 36 of Isaiah, and so the Rabshakeh is a spokesperson for King Sennacherib. So verse 4, "And the Rabshakeh said to them, 'Say now to Hezekiah, thus says the great king, the king of Assyria, what confidence is this in which you trust? I say you speak of having plans and powerful war, but they are mere words.'" It's all mockery. "Now in whom do you trust that you rebel against me? Look, you're trusting in the staff of this broken reed, Egypt, on which if a man leans, it will go into his hand and pierce it. So is Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to all who trust in him." He's saying, "Are you trusting in Egypt? Egypt's just down here. They're here. Okay. But if you say to me, 'We trust in the Lord our God,' is it not he whose high places and whose altars Hezekiah has taken away and said to Judah and Jerusalem, 'You shall worship God before this altar'? Now therefore I urge you, give a pledge to my master, the king of Assyria, and I will give you 2,000 horses, if you're able on your part to put riders on them." Okay, and he carries on, just mocking God and mocking God's people. And then the spokespeople would come out and say, don't speak to us in Hebrew. Speak to us in Assyrian, we understand that. And he says, no, they deserve to hear. In verse 12, it says, the Rabshakeh said, "Has my master sent me to your master and to speak these words, and not to the men who sit on the wall, who will eat and drink their own waste with you?" Basically saying, look, if we put a seed around you, you're going to end up eating your own waste and drinking your own urine. They deserve to hear what we're going to do to you. Okay, and he carries on, mocking God and mocking God's people. So that's kind of where we're at. That's actually happened in the past. So that event, when Sennacherib attacked, happens here, 701 years before Christ. So 70 years have passed, and you remember that that incident ended with God destroying 187,000 of Sennacherib's army. So now Nahum is coming now to preach to God's people, because they were still, sends his message to people of Judah, because they were still under threat from the Assyrians. They were still very much a threat to them. So let's now turn to Nahum. Someone got a page, please, for me.
824.
Okay. Nahum. And we'll read the first chapter. The burden against Nineveh, the book of the vision of Nahum the Elkoshite. And the first 8 verses are almost like a hymn or a song. God is jealous and the Lord avenges. The Lord avenges and is furious. The Lord will take vengeance on his adversaries, and he reserves wrath for his enemies. The Lord is slow to anger and great in power, and will not at all acquit the wicked. The Lord had his way in the whirlwind and in the storm, and the clouds are the dust of his feet. He rebukes the sea and makes it dry, and dries up all the rivers. Bashan and Carmel wither, and the flowers of Lebanon wilt. The mountains quake before him, and the hills melt, and the earth heaves at his presence, yes, the world and all who dwell in it. Who can stand before his indignation, and who can endure the fierceness of his anger? His fury is poured out like fire, and the rocks are thrown down by him. The Lord is good, a stronghold in the day of trouble, and he knows those who trust in him. But with an overflowing flood, he will make an utter end of its place, and darkness will pursue his enemies. What do you conspire against the Lord? He will make an utter end of it. Affliction will not rise up a second time. For while tamed like thorns, and while drunken like drunkards, they shall be devoured like stubble, fully dried. From you comes forth one who plots evil against the Lord, a wicked counsellor. Remember there, saying from you, from Nineveh, comes forth one who plots evil against the Lord, the kings of Nineveh, the kings of Assyria here. Thus says the Lord, though they are safe and likewise many, yet in this manner they will be cut down when he passes through. And then here God is speaking to his people in Judah. Though I have afflicted you, I will afflict you no more. For now, immediately, I will break off his yoke from you and burst your bonds apart. The Lord has given a command concerning you. Your name shall be perpetuated no longer. Out of the house of your gods, I will cut off the carved image and the molded image. I will dig your grave, for you are vile. Behold on the mountains the feet of him who brings good tidings, who proclaims peace. O Judah, keep your appointed feasts, perform your vows, for the wicked one shall no more pass through you. He is utterly cut off. Okay, as we said last week, as we read that passage, there's lots and lots of views in it. It's quite difficult to work out what is being said and to whom. We're going to look at verse 14. Verse 14. Alright. So, last week we looked at the first message of judgment, then there was a message of deliverance. Then we get to the second message of judgment in this chapter. The Lord has given a command concerning you. Your name shall be perpetuated no longer. Out of the house of your gods I will cut off the carved image and moulded image. I will dig your grave, for you are vile. So, the Lord has given a command concerning you. Who? As we said last week, you, in Hebrew can mean you as group, you on your own. You on your own as a female, or you on your own as a male. Or you as a group of males or females. The Lord has given a command concerning you. We're talking about a single person and a male person. As a fact, speaking of this person in verse 11, it says, from you comes forth one who plots evil against the Lord, a wicked counsellor. Okay, so this verse is about the wicked one who's coming out of Nineveh. The wicked one coming from Assyria. And commentators agree, talk about the king of Assyria, this really evil, wicked person, worthless person before God. And what's God's command against this evil, wicked person? But first of all, first thing he says is, your name shall be perpetuated no longer. Now we know how important it is if you're a king, that you actually have descendants. You have a son who's going to carry on your name. And what does God say? What's God's command? Your name shall be perpetuated no longer. Think of King Henry VIII, you know, how important it was for him to have seed and to carry on his line. And yet God comes along and says, against this wicked, evil person, your name shall be perpetuated no longer. Your name will not go forward. This will be the end for you. What else did he say? God's command against this evil, wicked, and worthless king. Out of the house of your gods, I will cut off a carved image, a moulded image. You might say, hey, why does a Nathan put this in here? Why has God prompted Nathan to write this? Well, if you remember the insults which King Sennacherib hurled at Judah, he was taunting Judah not to trust in their God. Okay? And then he sent another message, actually, he sent another message to King Hezekiah, persuading him to submit to him. So he sent the first one to him, and he sent another message to King Sennacherib. And I want you to just, as you listen to this passage, think to yourself, what argument is the king of Assyria putting forward why the nation of Judah should submit to him? So just listen to what King Sennacherib says. So King Sennacherib sends this message to Hezekiah the second time, and just listen. Okay, what's his argument for why they should submit? Isaiah 37. Do not let your God in whom you trust deceive you, saying, Jerusalem shall not be given into the hand of the king of Assyria. Look, you have heard what the kings of Assyria have done to all the land by utterly destroying them, and shall you be delivered? Have the gods of the nations delivered those whom my fathers have destroyed? So what's the argument? They send another message to the king of Assyria, and he's trying to persuade them to actually, you know, submit to him. And he says, look, you have heard what the kings of Assyria have done to the land for utterly destroying them, and shall we be delivered? Have the gods of the nations delivered those whom my fathers have destroyed? What was his argument there? Let's put a map up soon. What's going on? Okay, maybe he's sending this message to the people of Judah. What was his argument? Why was he trying to say to them, why you must submit to me?
Because he'd done away with all the other gods and your gods are no better.
Yeah, absolutely. We attack these other nations, their gods haven't done anything. You know? Have the gods of the nations delivered those who my fathers have destroyed? Basically saying, look, we've been around, we've destroyed all the other nations. Those other gods. We destroyed them all, those nations, their gods were nothing for us. We're more powerful than any gods. Our gods are more powerful than your gods. Who's your God? And how does Hezekiah respond to this? Well, Hezekiah actually prays to God. Here he is here. He's been surrounded. He's had the second message from King Sennacherib saying, you must submit to us. You know, who's your God to, you know, defend you? And how does Hezekiah respond? He prays to God. He didn't do that initially, but now he does pray to God. And can you turn to Isaiah 37, verse 16? Because Hezekiah now is coming before God and saying, well, we'll read it together. So what's Hezekiah's argument here? Well, just think about this. Hezekiah is coming to God, and he's now going to argue something with God. He wants God to answer his prayer. Isaiah 37, verse 16. Just someone read it, please. Isaiah 37, verse 16.
O Lord of hosts, God of Israel, the one who dwells between the cherubim, you are God, you alone, of all the kingdoms of the earth, you have made heaven and earth.
I'm just going to look at the case. I think I've got the...
Carry on.
I've got Ethan on your ear, I wouldn't hear, but maybe I've actually got the wrong.
That's verse 17. Yeah.
Okay, yeah, sorry.
Incline your ear, O Lord, and hear. Open your eyes, O Lord, and see. And hear all the words of Sennacherib, which he has sent to reproach the living God. Truly, Lord, the kings of Assyria have laid waste all the nations and their lands, and have cast their gods into the fire, for they were not gods, but the work of men's hands, wood and stone. Therefore they destroyed them. Now, therefore, O Lord, our God, save us from his hand, that all the kings of the earth may know that you are the Lord, you alone.
Okay, so Hezekiah's here. The army of Syria have come down and camped against them. They've sent the second message now to the people saying, you must submit to us. Hezekiah comes before God and he prays to God. So what's his argument about why God should actually hear his prayer? What was it we heard there?
Prove that he is God,
yeah.
Not like the other gods.
Absolutely. Come on, God, for your glory's sake, you need to come and answer us and save us. Show them that you are the true God. Okay, now therefore, Lord our God, save us from this hand, that all the kingdoms of the earth may know that you are the Lord, you alone. He comes before God and argues with God, you know, come and save us for your glory's sake, so all the nations will see who you are. It's all about... there's all a conflict between, you know, is God the true God, you know, all these other gods. It's all about that. And they don't come before and say, look, we've got better tanks than you. No, it's like, we destroy other gods, or we can destroy your God. Your God's not going to save you. And what was the end of Sennacherib, the king of Assyria? I think, you know, the irony here is, I'll shut my Isaiah up now, I hope you haven't. Can someone just read Isaiah 37, verse 37, please? What's the end of King Sennacherib?
So Sennacherib, king of Assyria, departed and went away, returned home, and remained at Nineveh. Now it came to pass, as he was worshipping in the house of Nisroch, his god, that his sons, Adrammelech and Sharezer, struck him down with the sword, and they escaped into the land of Ararat.
Thank you. Okay. So all the things, he's him boasting of his, you know, power of his gods and how worthless the other gods are. And here he is, he goes back home after having 187,000 of his army destroyed. He heads back to Nineveh, the capital of Assyria, goes in to worship his god. You know, he's so full of his god and how worthless the other gods are, how wonderful he is and how, you know. And there he is, he's actually killed in front of his gods. And, you know, I don't think you're more damaged to that God's power and hatred of idol worship than that. But in our passage, Nahum's prophesying about the future. I will cut off the carved image. Yes. Out of the house of your gods, I will cut off the carved image. This prophecy from Nahum is about what's going to happen. So yes, that's happened in the past, but... you know, God's going to continue to deal with them because they still worship these gods and they still despise the true and living gods. Clive Anthony, in his book called Opening Up Nahum, says, when Nineveh fell, the temples were filled with the slaughter of many penitents crying out to their gods. So you can imagine, here they are in Nineveh and the Babylonians go to attack, they come up and the Assyrians, they go into their temples and they're pleading to their gods. Well, that's where they were all killed. And we get to the last line of the verse. It says here, I will dig your grave before you are wild. And it's talking about the wicked one, the worthless one, the king of Assyria, and the kings of Assyria who set themselves up against God. I will dig your grave for you are wild. I wasn't quite sure what this means. I found different references to it. They kind of seem to agree that there's nothing worse if you go into battle than to have, you know, to be killed in battle and then not be carried home for burial. But for the enemy to actually dig a shallow grave and bury you in it. Oh, you know, it's such a disaster, such a... I don't know how to put it really. Undignified way to actually die. To go into battle and then the enemy to actually take your body and dig a shallow grave and bury it in an unmarked grave. Okay, and that's what God's saying. So he's saying to this king, this worthless one, this wicked one, I'm going to cut the name off, you're going to be destroyed. Your gods will be destroyed, I'm the true God, your gods are nothing before me, and I'm going to destroy you for you a while. It's a thing for God to say. I can't even imagine what, you know, picture that kind of thing for God to say, you a while. It's a command God's given about this wicked one. Alright. So what's our response to this? To this verse? What can we learn from this? First of all, I think we should be challenged. God put judgment on the Sennacherib for his worshipping of his idols, mocking God. And we don't make idols, we don't carve idols up. Of course we don't worship them. But are there other things that we, you know, put up there that we value highly as God? Things that, you know, maybe we feel illegitimate, things that easily creep up there. We've got to be careful we don't allow that to be the case. When the scribes and Pharisees asked Jesus, which is the first commandment, Jesus says in Mark 12, verse 30, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with your strength, and with all your strength." This is the first commandment. You know, do we try to love God like that? Also, of course, we should be encouraged. I think one of the ways we should be encouraged is to pray for God's glory. We think about Nehemiah. Nehemiah's prayer. Oh, I've got that down there. It was Hezekiah's prayer, wasn't it? We should be encouraged to pray for God's glory, because remember Hezekiah, he prays to God, and God hears his prayer, because he's praying for God's glory, and God actually hears his prayer. So we can see that quite clearly when he says, you know, "Come down, Lord, and do this, and show yourself to be the true God for the glory of your name and for us." God hears that prayer. And we should be encouraged to pray like that. Because the prayer was answered. Isaiah comes down and says to him, "Because you prayed that, God's going to hear your prayer, and they're not even going to set a single foot inside these walls. In actual fact, they're not going to fire a single bow and arrow, a bow at you, because you prayed this prayer." So we should be encouraged to pray for God's glory, and he will answer that prayer. Also, we should take encouragement. Christ has destroyed sin, death, and hell. We see here that the Lord has given the command of this evil, wicked one. And in verse 11 and 14, in verse 11 it says, this wicked one is a wicked counsellor. In verse 14, we see here that he's vile, this wicked one. And that can be translated as counsellor of Belial. And Belial speaks of worthlessness and wickedness. And in 2 Corinthians it says, "Do not be unequally yoked together with unbelievers, for what fellowship has righteousness with lawlessness, and what communion has light with darkness, and what accord has Christ with Belial?" So this wicked one, this worthless one, he led the Assyrians into all kinds of evil. They were plundering and destroying, and God put judgment on them. And this is a great picture of what Christ did when he died on the cross. He defeated sin, death, and hell. And that's what this is a really vivid picture of. Then we have a message of deliverance, verse 15. "Behold on the mountains, the feet of him who brings good tidings, who proclaims peace. O Judah, keep your appointed feast, perform your vows, for the wicked one, his worthless one again, shall no more pass through you." And this is a picture of Christ has done in destroying sin, death, and hell. And Satan, sorry. He is utterly cut off. So what is this a picture of? Well, you remember that Rabshakeh, he comes down and he's shouting outside of the walls of Jerusalem, and everyone in Jerusalem can hear him, and he's taunting God. But in this picture, we've got a different picture. We've got "Behold on the mountain, the feet of him who brings good tidings." The mountain around Jerusalem, the hills around Jerusalem, we've actually got something coming down, and they're not actually taunting God. What's the message they're bringing? They're proclaiming peace. So now you're saying, it won't be long before somebody's going to be coming down and bringing to you good news. What's the good news? The wicked one has been destroyed. The king of Assyria, the Babylonians, come in and they absolutely destroy the whole nation of Assyria. And it won't be long before around the city walls of Jerusalem, someone's going to be coming and shouting, "Peace! shouting, you know, it's all over. The battle's won. So what's the message that is being proclaimed? It says, the wicked one shall no more pass through you. He is utterly cut off. The wicked one is completely destroyed. No more will the Assyrians come up against you. The wicked one, he's no more. You can imagine how overjoyed the people of in Jerusalem would have been. Imagine as they hear that message shouts, you know, echoing through the city. Did you hear the news? You know, have you heard? The wicked one's been destroyed. The king of Assyria? Yeah, he's been destroyed completely. The whole nation's been wiped out. Imagine hugging each other, you know, celebrating, you know, the feelings of happiness that they've had. So what's this a picture of? What is this a picture of?
The gospel.
Yeah. It's a picture of the good news, and the battle is won. Christ has conquered on the cross. Sin, death, Satan are defeated. So what's our response to that? Well, it should be thankful that we are on the victory side. Christ has won. We should be thankful for the blessings that we enjoy in Christ. We should be thankful for our inheritance. Judah, they got to remain in Jerusalem. They weren't conquered. They weren't at this point. They stayed in Jerusalem. We have an eternal inheritance. Because of what Christ has done, his victory for us, we have a home in heaven. Also, it's a challenge, isn't it? What's the challenge that comes from this? That verse, what's the challenge for us?
To walk in obedience, I would think, possibly.
Yeah, to walk in obedience.
What else? Keep your appointed peace.
Oh, sorry, you jumped on a bit.
Have I?
Yeah.
Which verse did you?
Yeah, that one. Right. That's the first bit of it.
Listen.
To listen. Yeah? What do you mean?
Listen to the good tidings.
Listen to the good tidings, yeah, absolutely. And we did, and we were fortunate that we had those good tidings shared with us, so we are on the victory side. But imagine if we'd been the one who'd had, imagine we were, you know, near Nineveh, and we'd actually seen what had happened, we'd seen the destruction of the wicked one, and we were the one whose job it was to go back and to share the good news. We'd have run back to the people of Judah, and we'd have stood on the outside and said, you never believe it. You know, the king of Assyria, he at last has been overthrown. The nation is completely destroyed. Babylonians have taken over. And no more are they going to come down and attack us. We'd have been full of it. We'd have been full of the good news. So surely our challenge for us is, you know, are we like that to share the gospel? Because our message is better, bigger than that. Yes, this is a picture of what Christ has done for us in destroying the wicked one. Because Paul actually likens the preachers to the messenger that was sent down. In Romans chapter 10, let me just turn to that. Romans chapter 10. Okay, and Paul's actually saying how important it is that we have a preacher, the importance of a preacher. And this is what we should be doing, and he actually likens it to the messenger. He actually quotes from Nahum, chapter 1, verse 15. Verse 14, so I'll just read from verse 14. How then shall they call on him in whom they have not believed? And how shall they believe in him of whom they have not heard? And how shall they hear without a preacher? And how shall they preach unless they're sent? And this is it, so he's quoting from Nahum, saying, you know, this is what preachers should be like, this is what we should be like, sharing the gospel. We should be like this messenger who comes down with this good news. How beautiful are the feet of those who preach the gospel of peace, who bring glad tidings of good things. And in my Bible, it references the fact that it's in Nahum, chapter 1, verse 15. So it's what preachers are likened to, those who bring good tidings of good news. That's what we should be like. We've got this good news, and we should be like this messenger, you know, wanting to share it out, this message of peace. And finally, the last part of this verse. O Judah, keep your appointed feast, perform your vows. The wicked one shall no more pass through you, he's utterly cut off. So here's the people in Judah. So this message comes, good news. You know, you're on the victory side, the battle's won, and for us, Christ has conquered sin, death, and hell, and no more. We're on the victory side, and that'll be fully accomplished and complete when He comes again. But what should we do? What's it say? Adjudicate the point of peace. They were told to carry on worshipping God. Okay, carry on worshipping God. That's my notes. There they are. They should carry on their feast of celebration and worship. They should carry on the feast of the Passover, the feast of tabernacles. They should now carry on these feasts of worship to God. And then he says, O Judah, keep your appointed feast, perform your vows, continue your acts of service, acts of worship and service for deliverance that God has brought to his people Judah. So finally, what should our response be to the good news of the gospel that we've received? Well, we should worship him. That should be our natural response. We should worship him. We should give him the love and praise of our hearts. In our singing, in our praying, in reading and listening to God's words. As we meet around the Lord's table, we should be our response to this good news should be one of worship to him. Just as people of Judah were instructed to do. You must keep your appointed feast. You must perform your vows. That's the same for us. We've got this great news of the gospel, and when we benefit from that, and our response should be one of worship to him, and to perform your vows, what's that talking about? Acts of service to him, we should be living our lives for him. He's brought us a message of deliverance and peace, and we're to respond with worship and service, just as he called Judah to. Right, chapter 1 done. I find it beneficial. It's quite difficult to go through it, but I think if I just do it, just apply it and go through, and hopefully we'll get some nuggets of blessing from it, I'm sure. Bruce, what's the time?
20 past.
Is it?
No, it's 26 minutes.
Oh, right, okay.
10.
Alright, so I've got a hymn we can sing before we come to prayer.